Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Paul. Good to be here again with you, and I'd like to welcome all our listeners to the next chapter with Charlie. I'm Charlie Hedges, and this is the show where we discuss ideas for you and your next chapter in life. My special guest today is our good old friend Terry Hershey. If you're a frequent listener of the show, then you're very familiar with Terry, who is a regular guest. Terry is a prolific writer, conference keynote speaker, renowned landscape architect, and spiritual divisor. That probably is true, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
He's a spiritual advisor, not divisor.
I'm still stuck on you good old friend, not good young friend. Just got the good old friend thing.
Well, it's a good old friend because we've been friends for a long time.
Oh, I see. We've been friends for a while. Yeah,
that's it. We've been friends for a long time.
I'm not sensitive about my age or anything.
No, you're not. And I'm older than you, and I'm not sensitive about my age.
That's true. You look, actually, you would look younger than me.
Well, no, now not now that I'm balding, but if I turn around my ponytail, I may look younger than you.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good.
Today, I tell you what I want to do. You and I chatted, and today I want to talk about an interesting subject that was on your mind, and that is how to take possession of your own life. We all seem to too frequently give others permission to have some kind of control over certain aspects of our lives, and we generally wind up frustrated, overwhelmed, or depressed. Not a good deal. So this is our subject for the day. I'm calling it, Terry, I'm calling it Who Owns You? So welcome. And it's been a while. How have things been with you?
It has been a while. Well, I was sick in December.
That's right.
Yeah, and had the flu, and apparently the flu is bad this year. Really bad. Killed a bunch of kids, you know, in the United States. I mean, it's a serious flu. Anyway, I've never had the flu, so I had in December. I didn't know what hit me. And so you go in the doctor, and they ask you a very technical medical question. They say, do you feel like you've been hit by a truck?
And seriously, did the doctor really say that?
Yeah, seriously. And you say yes, and then she says, okay, that's the flu.
Okay, so that's exciting. So now give me, what's the result?
Well, I lost 15 pounds. And
oh, that's good.
Yeah, was down for the whole month of December, which is good because you read a lot of books. And
oh, you were still healthy enough to read.
Well, the first week I wasn't, but after a while you are because you can't do anything. So, but then that's good. So, and then that was December, and then it's good to be, I hate being sick, but it was nice to do that. Catch up.
Nice to take a break.
Yeah, and then last week I was in Spain, so yeah, it's been a while.
Oh, you were in Spain? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
A wine tasting or a different thing?
No, I'm trying to move out of this country.
Are you trying to move out of this country? Where did you try in Spain?
No, I tell you what, though. I was tempted because I was in Rioja. You know, I go every year to do a wine tasting thing with my friends, and there's a guy who just moved from Los Angeles. And as you know, in Southern Cal, price is crazy. So he's got two kids, bought a four-bedroom house and, 3,000 square feet for $50,000 in Rioja.
Where is that? I mean, what is it near?
That's north of Madrid. You know the wine, Rioja.
No, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's the oldest wine in Spain. Anyway, it's a very famous, popular wine, Rioja. And so it's the region north of Spain. You go over the mountains, and it's very rural. A lot of little villages.
Oh.
Each village has a church, and each village has a castle, an old castle.
And a winery?
And more than one.
More than one.
Mm-hmm.
One church, one castle, many wineries.
Many wineries, yeah.
Yeah, sounds like a cool place.
My favorite thing about Spain is went out because my friend is a wine writer, so we got in great wineries, and we went in one, and they're very old school. Everything is really old. Same kind of stuff they've done even over 100 years ago, the way they do the wine. And we're going to go out to dinner with them, and we're in our American mode. And she says, you have to realize we don't rush here.
Right. Dinner's
that.
Not till 10
yeah.
or 11.
Well, dinner wasn't until, we didn't meet till 9. But
right.
We don't, I like that. We don't rush here.
Yeah.
So just a whole paradigm change. I mean,
it really is. And you know what I found really interesting is that they start drinking wine very young. And then the drinking age is younger, but there are restrictions. And you have, as a result, you have phenomenally fewer alcoholics in Spain than you do in the United States that has a lot of restrictions on drinking.
And the way it is with drinking with kids is they don't give them a glass of wine, but they give them bread to dip in the wine. But the whole point of it is to taste it. In other words, so they understand taste, because everything about wine is about all of your senses.
Right.
And it's a powerful, that's the same with gardening, you know, all of your senses are involved. That's a big deal for me, to be present, to be really present, you know.
Yeah, that is great. And talking about gardening, before we get into our topic, I wanted to have a brief discussion. You are in, some may call it winter wonderland and some may call it winter hell in Seattle. Tell me, what kinds of lessons do you have from what I'm calling the cold death found in winter gardening in Seattle as you await spring?
Is this where I'm supposed to sound positive?
No. No, I don't think you do.
Outside, well, but
except
Charlie,
you except you will
dumping
because
rain, literally
because
dumping
can,
rain.
Dumping you know? Rain, is it?
Yeah, dumping rain. And the only reason it's okay is because there's a fire in the fireplace and I'll be downstairs in a minute and I'm not on the East Coast where it's, you know, still crazy.
Yeah.
So the winter thing, yeah. May Sarton, great, great lesson. She said, gardening is not for the young because young people can't handle death.
And certainly in real winter, there is.
And winter is all about death. It's all about downtime. That's the whole point.
Is it about death or is it about hibernation, Terry? Is there a
difference? Wrong with death? You're dying. You die.
But you come back, but you resurrect.
Yeah, well, resurrection. I mean, you're a Christian. You believe in both of those things.
I do.
Resurrection can't happen until after death.
That's true.
You don't resurrect a slumbering bear.
Right.
You just awake a bear.
Yeah. Oh, you got to resurrect a dead bear.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously the plants are alive under the soil, but there's just something about it. And if that freaks you out, then you don't understand that this is the time to literally just be still. There's so many other things that can be done during winter. And now, the good thing about it, even though the weather is right now bleak and gloomy, you know, the daffodils are peeking out of the ground. So, you know, we're ready to rock and roll in a month.
There's always that little bit of encouragement.
Always something. It's great.
When I was last year in Scandinavia in the deepest time of winter in January, I wrote a, I don't know if it was a post or if I just wrote a lesson in my journal, but winter is highly underrated. There is something beautiful about the stark barrenness of the trees and.
Well, that's because, speaking of our subject, which is about our identity, when my friends and I travel every January for this wine thing, we go to gardens. And he says, man, why do you want to go to a garden in winter? That's crazy. And so whatever city we're in, you know, whether it's Paris or Madrid or whatever, you go to the nice gardens. And he said, man, it's not for me. What are you going to see? But that's the whole point. In the winter, what you see are the bones. The bones are what exists when all of the foliage is down.
Perfect.
In other words, that's the basic. That's the rock of what that garden is. A garden is as good as its bones. And if the bones are beautiful, it's an extraordinary garden.
You've always told me that. Yeah, I appreciate that. I think it's a metaphor that holds true for life. And
yeah.
as we're talking about life and we're talking about identity, why don't we move into our topic? And we were chatting yesterday or day before, I can't recall, and as last week, and I invited you on the show, and you asked you, was there anything hot on your mind that you wanted to talk about? And you mentioned the subject of personal ownership and who owns you. And why don't you tell me just a bit more about what you were thinking about owning your own life?
Well, I mean, one of the things that it's no secret that the current public discourse in the United States is noisy and not pleasant. And they did a survey about how people felt after 2017 was over. And you know what the number one answer was from people after 2017? They felt exhausted. And it makes sense. It doesn't matter. It's not a political statement. It's just that we're more bombarded than ever. And we feel at the mercy of it. We feel at the mercy of the news. We feel at the mercy of breaking news. We feel at the mercy of somebody from the other side. We feel at the mercy of vitriolic talk. We feel at the mercy. And we don't feel like it's ours anymore. Because what I have discovered is when you're at the mercy, you're reactive. And so a lot of public discourse is that way. We become reactive. Not because I've made a choice about who I am, what I want to say, or who I want to be. It's that I feel owned by the circumstances around me.
Boy, I really like that idea of we are at the mercy. And I think, I don't think I've ever felt, and I don't want this to turn into a political show, but I don't think I've ever felt at the mercy of government as I feel it right now.
Yeah, and so what's interesting is as long as I feel at the mercy, then I have the sense that somebody else is doing this to me, and I feel like my choice is taken away. And so I quoted Viktor Frankl, you know,
yeah,
in the Last Sabbath Moment, and he said, I don't care what, I'm paraphrasing, and of course he lived through the Holocaust. He said, I don't care what circumstances are happening to you, there's one thing that can never be taken away from you.
Right.
And that's your attitude.
Your attitude, yes.
In other words, and basically, that's the core of your choice making. And your choice making is predicated on the fact that you have a self to choose from. And so that's why it's scary for a lot of people is, you know, when I'm at the mercy and I don't know what to do, it's like, who the hell am I?
Terry, that's quite a fascinating notion that you you advocate that you do have a choice in your life.
Yes, you always have a choice.
And we can fall into that victim mentality to where we have no choice and we are literally at the mercy and we sit around and wait for whatever's coming down the pike and take that rather than taking control of our own lives. And how are we going to handle it? And how are we going to manage the good parts of our life? Because even in the midst of, no matter what any government or anybody does, we can have wonderful experiences in our life and we can be deeply fulfilled and imaginative people.
Exactly. And we can, yeah. I tell a story in my Sabbath moment. I think I told it to you about a young pastor and an old pastor having a conversation. It's a church story, but it still applies.
It still applies, yeah.
It's like the preacher said, I'm not preaching now, this part's true.
Okay. So tell me the true part.
The young pastor was at this, you know, a church that's exploding. You know, they meet in a gymnasium or something somewhere. You know, now hundreds and thousands of people. And so, and when you have that, you have the, you know, the typical frustration that comes with all that, you know, choices and decisions to make, etc. So he says to the older pastor, he says, this is nuts. This is crazy. I mean, we're breaking the doors out, but this is amazing. And he said, you know, there's nothing we can do about it. And the older pastor said, well, you can say, our church is growing and we're grateful. And he said, but yeah, but it's nothing we've done. And the older pastor said, Well, you did keep putting up chairs, you know. Which I love.
Yeah.
In other words, I forget the reality that I can keep putting up chairs or taking down chairs. I mean, in the way I react and respond to some things. One of the things that happened when I was sick in December is I went for a week without watching the news.
Oh, well, that's nothing unusual for me. So what was
I know,
that
but
like
that's the
you?
First week I didn't have depression the entire year.
Yeah, I go by the philosophy. I don't watch, read, or listen to it. If anything important happens, someone's going to tell me about it.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
But
it's an interesting thing about the ownership part is that if people are telling me, if they're bombarded by whatever the circumstances are, I get it. I'm not going to make the circumstances go away with a magic wand. But how I navigate that is predicated on the fact that I believe inside of me is the capacity to make choices.
What kinds of choices, Terry?
I can choose what I look at and how I look at it. I can choose what I internalize and what I don't. I can choose to believe what it says about me and what it doesn't. I can choose to feel like a victim in all of this, or I can choose to be a place where I navigate it with people around me who are bombarded by the same circumstances.
And then you live the kind of life you want in spite of what.
And yeah, and then you live that kind of life. You see it. I mean, you know, a microcosm, Charlie. Look at the natural disasters that happened in California in different places.
Right.
And look at the way certain people handled it. You know, for some people, the disaster is your entire life. It's your whole life.
Right.
For some people, it's just something that's really ugly that needs to be navigated.
That is, boy, and that's what an attitude that is that how frequently do we look at some negative event in our life and we view that as a life-altering, a life-changing. How many times have we used that's a life-changing moment?
Mm-hmm.
Well, really? I mean, you know, it was a very experiential and involved moment, but it's not certainly not life-changing because you're going back to the same home, driving the same car, doing the same job, pretty much acting the same way. So it really didn't change your life that much.
Yeah, I mean that's a good reframe. So what it is, it's a life circumstance changing, no doubt about it.
Yes, and it gives you and it adds more data for you to use.
Sure,
and it
is real. And with the life circumstance changing, there may be grief and pain and other things that go with it. But I still get to say how the story ends.
Now that's interesting that you would use the word story because I, as you can imagine, I did a little research before we came on air, and I was reading this last weekend. I was reading Brain Pickings by the ever so brilliant Maria Popova, and she was writing about Oliver Sacks, you know, the famous physician author, and he wrote this. If we wish to know about someone, we ask, what is your story, your real innermost story? And Sacks contends that each of us is our story. Each of us is a singular narrative which is constructed continually unconsciously by us, through us, and in us. I really warm to that notion that each of us is a story and we have a story to tell. And we get to use facts, but interpret that story. There's myriad of interpretations of that story, and it's up to us to interpret that story that is a healthy story and puts us in a good position, not in a victim mode, but in a power mode.
Yeah, I mean, 'cause the the deal is, and it, doesn't he use the word narrative too a lot?
Yeah, well, yeah. I have another quote, but he uses the word narrative. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Because narrative is really that. A narrative is a great word for me. Is because I'm always asking, you know, who controls the narrative of my life? And you know, anybody who's done therapy wrestles with that, because you know, many of us have had the narrative of one of our parents or both of our parents or somebody. And we end up living out our young adult days, you know, with somebody else's narrative. And this is not about making ourselves collapse with some sort of regret, but it's simply an ownership that says there is within me a sufficiency to say who I'm going to dance for. One of the most powerful things you have when you have conversations with people when they're bombarded by whatever circumstance in their life is you ask them literally, what would you choose to do? And they look at you blank, as in, really? I have a choice?
I know. Boy, Terry, you know, you just asked a really powerful question. Who am I going to dance for? That is, I've just been writing about the problem with external affirmation and
right.
people pleasing and
right.
who am I dancing for? Am I dancing for an audience or am I dancing for myself? And, you know, I personally would include my loved ones, you know, my close family.
Sure.
That I'm dancing for them as well. But outside of that, you know, I'm deeply involved in dance and I may go through a step dance with friends, But the dance really is an internal dance, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean,
I love this concept of dancing with life. I just, there's something about it that resonates so deeply with me.
Yeah, and I think, but let's put a positive spin on it. See, because a lot of times when people hear it, say, yeah, I know, I'd love to be able to make choices. I'd love to take ownership. I'd love to write the own narrative. But I must suck at it because I'm not doing that. And so, you know, then you're going down that victim road again. Rather than asking the positive question, tell me what's going on inside. Tell me what you would choose. Tell me what does wake your heart up. Tell me what does invite you to dance. Those are the things that are a part of you of you internally. That's your sufficiency that enables you to make choices. That's the gift you give to anyone around you.
You know, I want to get into this more deeply in a minute, but I do want to ask this one question first. Can you, in just, you know, briefly, can you describe your narrative that, you know, do you have an overarching narrative or is it very complex that's difficult to explain?
My narrative, I'm sitting at my desk, so let
okay,
me
you
grab.
You know what we're going to do? We're going to take a break.
Yeah,
and you can grab and sit, and we'll come right back.
Yep.
Hi, this is Charlie Hedges, and you're listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie, and I'm here with my special guest and dear friend, Terry Hershey, and we are talking about what it takes to own yourself. We're asking the question, who owns you? And right now, and Terry and I have been talking about personal narrative, and that you are your story, and you get to frame or describe or create that story any way you want, based, you're limited to certain data, but based on that. And then I asked Terry before the break if he had a brief explanation of his personal narrative. And he said he did and was going to look it up on somewhere and let us know. So, Terry, you're on, buddy.
Yeah, I Googled Terry's Narrative. And it's a flower shop there in Santa Monica.
that's good.
No, I grabbed my narrative is actually when I wrote my narrative when I wrote my book Soul Gardening.
Your favorite book.
My favorite book that I wrote.
Yeah.
And that I've written, yeah. And so because I once asked my psychiatrist, you know, why I was in therapy, and he told me it would make me a better gardener.
Seriously?
Yeah.
What a good therapist.
Isn't that great?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so here's my narrative. My narrative is that there's a wondrous, I'm going to read to you. There's a wondrous and incurable obsession which takes you meandering garden paths just for the sake of meandering. Of course, the obsessed tend toward jealous excess, and I will be unable to hide my proclivity for the sacred necessity of Adirondack chairs, my infatuation with old garden roses, my enchantment with early summer's butterfly cabaret, or my distrust of anyone who's put off by dirty fingernails, just so you are forewarned.
So your narrative is all around gardening, but the gardening obviously is a metaphor for life.
It's about paying attention. It's about being present. Here, I'll read you one more paragraph. Because I was raised, the narrative that I was raised with, very conservative, as you know, very conservative religious upbringing, right?
Yes.
And the narrative was essentially, don't piss God off.
Yeah.
And or whoever else was supposed to be God's spokespeople on earth.
Right.
And so it was never you. It was just looking over your shoulder so you didn't get whacked. And so spirituality was basically like, you know, trying to stay out of hell.
Well,
so with this new narrative, here's the paragraph. Spirituality, however, is not a lottery ticket to the next life, but a front row center ticket to this one. This life, with its bad traffic, its ill-timed meetings, its bleeding cell phones, its demanding children, its traffic snarls, and its yammering pain-in-the-neck obligations. This life, where once in a while, just for a minute, you stop what you're doing and you watch the clouds roll through the northern sky, a conveyor belt of fleece, and the wind is out of the southwest filling your lungs, and you catch a glimpse of a blue heron gliding like a javelin across the sky. The world is now on center stage, no longer peripheral to your duties and obligations, and the full weight of this moment seeps its way back into the grind of the everyday, slowing your heartbeat, giving you a gentler step and a gleam in your eye.
Well, first of all, I've got to say that's so nicely written.
Thank you.
I really like that. And I also like the very simple phrase at the early part of your paragraph there, a front row center ticket to life.
Yeah.
That's what you're getting at when you're talking about presence, isn't it?
Yeah, because my narrative, it's interesting. My narrative, as you can see, is not about what I want to be or what job I want to have. In other words, I can do any number of jobs with that narrative.
Exactly. So help us uneducated. What if it's not about job, which obviously it's not, what would you say, how would you define what it is about?
It's about how to be human, how to be fully alive, how to be wholehearted, how to bring my whole heart to it. So if my skill set happens to be accounting, I will bring my whole heart to that. If my skill set happens to be writing books, I will bring my whole heart to that.
You know, it's interesting. I just read, somebody sent me a thing via email on Steve Jobs' last words before he died, and he really poo-pooed achievement and accomplishments. I mean, it was just, he just kind of like poo-pooed his whole life and talked about relationships and friends and a number of other things that we all deem important. But it was interesting that Steve Jobs found that near his death. But he made one statement. He says, there is a huge difference between human being and being human, and if you don't get that, then you don't have a chance.
Right.
I like that. A big difference between
too.
Human being and being human. And what you're talking about is being human.
Yeah.
And being human is being the real you.
Yeah.
Which is so difficult when we live in a world that wants to define us. And unfortunately, because we have been brought up in this world and educated into this world, we have bought into that lie that we want others to define us. We're always seeking, I don't know if I mentioned it on the air or not, but we're always seeking external personal affirmation. We're always looking for someone else to affirm us, to say, yes, we are good. And then we walk away thinking we're good, when they are not the final arbiter. It is up to us to decide our goodness or satisfaction or contentment or well-being. It's not up to somebody else to make that determination.
Right.
But it takes a ton of convincing, Terry, to get out of that. You know, I mean, you know how difficult it is to get away from this affirmation of other people.
Well, more often than not, we don't even realize we're doing it.
You know, that is so true. I'm going through a process of I've hired a new coach once again, and she is taking me through this process, and I'm right in the middle of the process of identifying me, and not in light of what others think, but in light of what gives me contentment, joy, pride within me. Not caring what other people think.
And those aren't always easy questions, are they?
Oh, my goodness. No. I mean,
Do you remember Julia Roberts, when she was going to get married and she didn't get married, for Runaway Bride or whatever it was called?
Kind of.
Yeah. So she goes down the aisle to marry these guys, like three or four or five of them or whatever. But she runs away at the altar every time. In other words, she doesn't.
Oh, no, I don't think I saw the film.
Yeah. Anyway, so Richard Gere comes to write a story about this woman who keeps running away from weddings, and of course they fall in love, etc. But they can't make it happen. She runs away from their potential wedding too. And because they had a conversation one time, it's just a small thing, but it really was graphic. He said they were gonna have breakfast, and said, what kind of eggs you want? And it hit her. She didn't know what kind of eggs she wanted. And the reason is because she liked the kind of eggs for everybody she was going to marry. And so there's this great scene where she makes eggs every different kind of way. And she, it was the first time she ever ate eggs to decide what she wanted.
That's very similar to that story from Pretty Woman, isn't it?
Yeah.
Who are you? Who do you want me to be?
Yeah, who do you want me to be?
Yeah, yeah. So she's got a couple good lines there. I want to do something else here, and I hope these quotes are really similar, but I want to talk more about story, because I think the essence of who owns you and who are you is really formulated by your story, that you make for yourself, that you write for yourself, you create or dictate for yourself. Would you think that's true?
Yeah.
Okay, so Sacks, again, quoting Oliver Sacks, who I would recommend to anybody to read just about anything he's written, but he writes this: to be ourselves, we must possess ourselves. If need be, to repossess ourselves, our life stories. We must recollect ourselves, recollect the inner narrative or inner drama. A person needs such a narrative, a continuous inner narrative, to maintain your identity, your own self. So you've talked about narrative. He's talking about narrative. We need to, according to Sacks and according to you, we need to maintain a narrative that accurately, at least for this time, because we're always in flux, we're always changing, we're always evolving, but for this time, describes a true inner you.
Right. Yeah, and not be afraid of the fact that we don't always know. I mean, part of it is just simply asking those kind of things.
Oh, yeah, because we don't always know.
What is my choice here? Yeah, I mean, what?
Let me, I have something else I want to add. recently I had a guest, Jamie Lerner, the author of The Ever-Loving Essence of You. And we were talking also about storyline, only on a sort of a different take of it. But she talked about reframing your own story, and that we can reframe, and I'm putting it in our context now, we can reframe our own story, and one way we can go about personal ownership is that,
right.
is that we take whatever story we have right now and we reframe it as positive. Do you think that's, or as accurate, whether it's positive or not, because it's not always positive, but it's an accurate representation of who I am. And if I can get that, I am really comfortable. If I'm really comfortable with who I am, knowing who I am, then I can be comfortable with who I am.
Yeah. At home in my own skin, I agree with that.
Yeah.
So I take a circumstance, and you're not trying to be Pollyanna about a reframe. You know, you're not trying to whitewash it all. But, you know, remember back in the day when we did divorce recovery stuff. Remember?
Right.
So I'm going through, let's just say I'm going through that, and the narrative can be one thing from the church and one thing from your relatives and one thing from whoever. And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't sound very good who I am, all that stuff. Well, the reframe is, yes, I'm divorced. I take ownership in screwing up this. But however, even given all that, I have the capacity to give, and I have the capacity to change, and I have the capacity to make whole, and I have the capacity to love. I mean, you know, the point is the reframe says that there's more to me than just those things about me.
That, yeah, I like, you know, I believe I probably told this story a couple of weeks ago, but I'm going to take a chance on telling the story because it really does, it really does explain how to reframe a story. And I will tell it quickly this time. As many know, I was homeless until I was 7 or 8. I had a home to live in, but I mean, I had a place to live, but I did not have a home until I was 7 and a half. And I have walked away from that for my entire life. And with all of my therapy, I walked away with a storyline that I was abandoned and rejected. So I had a negative storyline for those times, which are both true. Those are not untruths, but there's more to the story because I started thinking, and it began simply with, I really can adapt to change very easily. Change doesn't bother me at all. So that was a positive that I learned during those years, having lived with so many different people. I adapt to a new situation, a new living situation, a new house, a new family. And I can adapt. Also, I can be creative and learn how to adjust to these people. So I am an accepted member of this family. And finally, at 7 and a half, I mean, how many 7 and a half-year-olds make a determination to run away from home? I mean, that's not something 7 and a half-year-olds do. And yet I did that. So it started my decision-making and leadership. So now I look back at that time, and I've reframed that time, I certainly accept rejection and abandonment as things that I have to deal with, but say also there's another story there. There's a story that's very positive that have given me, I think, some of my strongest gifts today, which are the ability to change, the ability to lead, the ability to make decisions, the ability to be empathetic and read a situation. All of that came from those years. So
yeah.
That's completely reframing that story, is it not?
That's a great way to say it. That's a great reframe, too. Those two things are true about you. Abandoned, that's true. That's like my house burned down. You can't deny your house didn't burn down.
Right.
That's just true. That's a true statement. It's silly to pretend otherwise. But that tells you what circumstances are happening to you, but it doesn't acknowledge what's inside of you. But your capacity is
exactly, and what you learned and what you gained, and not just learned, but see, I didn't just learn it; I did these things, and they became part of my being, and I failed to recognize that it was that time period that caused that or that instigated all of that.
Right.
What I'd like to do right now, as we're wrapping up, I feel a need to get tactical because I feel that our listeners may be truly resonating with what we're talking about, but they don't know the first step. Do you have any ideas of? I know you really don't like steps 1, 2, and 3, but sometimes our readers need that. Is there a starting point to choosing your own narrative, reframing your narrative, not allowing yourself to be victim and exhausted in the mercy of the government?
Yeah. I've always been a huge fan of the journaling, and even if it's not a long journal, it's a short journal. But I've always been a big fan of writing things down. And look at the tactical thing. What did Julia Roberts do? She cooked eggs like 7 different ways and tasted them. I mean, it's the same with writing. When I'm journaling, I'm writing about that. What is my choice here? In other words, I see this circumstance, and I assume from the circumstance in the frame that there's only one option here. Okay? So my journal starts with, really? Really?
Oh, so you question yourself in your journal.
Yeah.
You write what seems
and,
to be a
and
given.
I ask the question, I feel terribly afraid, or I feel inadequate, okay? And then the second question, very tactical, the second question is, where does that come from? Where did that come from? And I'll be damned. I can hear a voice from my childhood that told me that. Or whatever.
Perfect. Also, okay, so let's move on from the childhood reframing to what do I need to do to reframe my life at 68 years old, to recollect or rename my narrative?
What do you mean reframe it now?
I'm really in tune. I'm not dependent on what other people think, but on what I think. And
right.
And I want to live. You know, I like Daniel Klein's quest when he was in his early 70s of he went out to find what is meaningful life in old age before I hit old age. And that's sort of where I'm at right now. What is the meaning of life in this change? Because I'm different at 68 years old than I was at 48 years old.
Right.
My energy, my desire.
It's really simple. I mean, I say it's really simple, but you know, tell me where your heart lands every day. Tell me where you're glad. What promotes gladness?
Okay. You're really getting now. I'm afraid we're going to go long. Tell me because what if I find no place of gladness?
I would say that's not true.
I would agree.
Because you just told me you have this great aspiration about what you want to do at this age in your life. That's gladness, dude. I hate to break it to you.
What about, you know what I'm thinking about? Is I'm thinking about some people that are listening and saying, what brings you gladness? What brings you happiness? And they can't even access that, Terry. You know, you've spoken with them as I have. And all they see is gloom and doom. How do we help them to reframe their story? What encouragement can we give them
that's what people say to me. People say to me, man, I just, my life sucks, and I wish if I had courage, I'd be okay. I'd say, okay, you do. No, I don't. I said, you just spent time coming to me and telling me your story. It's called courage. You just spent time listening to this wonderful podcast. That's called curiosity. Why? Curiosity in what? Curiosity in adding something to your own life.
So what we would want to do is, I like the idea of journaling, and I like the idea, I really advocate the idea of writing things down. If it's not a journal, even if it's lists of who I am, really not by what other people think I am, but what do I love doing? What brings me fulfillment? And I would add, because I believe in Aristotle's, our job is to contribute to the value of society. How do I contribute in my life? How do I do good? Because if I'm only self-centered, then that's only going to take me so far.
Right.
But if I take that self-centeredness and maximize that self-centeredness and use it to do good in the world,
I agree.
Then I live a fabulous life. Terry, thank you so much for being on the show.
Charles. Always good.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you. And I also want to thank all our listeners for tuning in to The Next Chapter with Charlie. And I encourage you to check out our website at thenextchapter.life. That's .life. And until next, this is Charlie signing off. Bye for now.